You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 17th of September 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson, and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, Taiwan invests almost $9 billion in defence. With almost daily threats from Beijing, we'll ask if Taipei is doing enough to keep its enemy at bay. Also ahead, we examine why, although Russia's forthcoming parliamentary elections may not be free or fair, they matter. We'll stay with the election theme for our final instalment on the snap polls in Canada. Today, our focus is on the right wing and its leader.
Max is Maxime Bernier, the former Member of Parliament who established the People's Party of Canada in 2018.
Plus, we'll review Friday's papers and Andrew Muller will be here to bring us up to speed on the last 7 days' news that we might have missed.
We learned a surprising amount about the testicles of a friend of a cousin of Super Bass and Starships hitmaker Nicki Minaj.
That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Italy is to introduce some of the strictest coronavirus measures in the world, making it compulsory for all workers to have a COVID green pass. China has applied to join a key Asia-Pacific trade pact, the CPTPP. It's being seen as a move to strengthen its position in the region. The pact was originally created to counter China's influence. And the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has attempted to calm relations with France after the US, UK and Australia signed a defence export contract to supply Australia with submarines. France says it's been stabbed in the back. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, the Taiwanese government has announced it is to spend more on defence. A lot more. Almost $9 billion, in fact. With it, it will buy more cruise missiles and warships. It's in an effort to fend off what it claims are now almost daily threats from Beijing. Well, Isabel Hilton is the CEO of China Dialogue and a regular voice here on Monocle 24. Very good morning to you, Isabel.
Good morning.
So how bad are these threats, Isabel?
Well, the threat is constant and always there. I guess the question is, you know, is the threat that the threat is real? China has stated repeatedly, and there's no reason to doubt that it wishes to, as it would say, recover Taiwan, the renegade province. But the question is when and how, and that remains, of course, ambiguous.
So tell us a little bit more about what Taiwan is now doing. I mean, $9 billion sounds like a very large amount of money to allocate.
It is a large amount of money. Essentially, Taiwan's defence depends on both Taiwan's readiness to defend itself, but also on the implicit idea that the United States would come to its defence. And that has always been slightly deliberately ambiguous because the treaty between the United States and Taiwan commits the United States to enable Taiwan's defence, in other words, to supply whatever equipment Taiwan needs to defend itself. There has always been an understanding, but it's never stated that would, if push came to shove, that the United States would step up and counter a Chinese military attack. At the same time, the understanding is that Taiwan, although it can function largely as an independent country, would not do anything to provoke such an attack, and declaring independence would be such a provocation. Now, the DPP, who run Taiwan at the moment, the elected government of Taiwan, is essentially an independence party. It has not declared independence, but whenever the DPP is in power, the pressure from China escalates. And this has been worse because of Xi Jinping's posture in the region, which is far more assertive. So many more incursions, much larger air incursions, many more threats. The question is, how can Taiwan defend itself? So it's spending, as you say, nearly $9 billion now. And there's been rather a public discussion between certain US military authorities and the Taiwanese about how Taiwanese should should defend itself. You know, Taiwan is tiny compared to the compared to China, and it has hitherto spent most of its money buying very expensive American fighters, the F-16. There's always a row with China whenever a new round of fighters are ordered, but that's really been the mainstay, the idea that the Air Force will be the mainstay of its defense. There are some US military analysts who are critical of that strategy and feel that a more thought out asymmetric defense with a protracted guerrilla warfare with different levels of military defense would be more effective, because they point out that the Air Force could be knocked out in a first strike. And so what we're seeing with this purchase is a wider range of options that Taiwan is being forced to invest in from both sides. In fact, it's nevertheless a kind of very open question, particularly with China's military modernization, as to whether Taiwan itself could resist an invasion.
So what will this money buy then?
Well, it's going to buy a range of smaller ships. It's going to buy a range of missiles. So F-16s are not in the shopping list. So it's a range of alternative options for Taiwan, and that ought to equip a different strategy. But whether that really emerges, we'll see.
What does the allocation of $9 billion or the equivalent in Taiwan do to the Taiwanese economy?
Well, the Taiwanese economy is pretty healthy. I mean, it is a fairly substantial sum of money, but the economy itself, of course, is another target for China's action. China excels in what are known as grey zone tactics. So that includes undermining public morale. It includes, lots of propaganda, lots of misinformation, interfering in elections, as well as the threat of military aggression and the incursions that I mentioned. It also includes trying to squeeze the economy, and a lot of the economy is dependent on China. I mean, Taiwan can afford this. It's a very it is a thriving economy, but again, that is an area of vulnerability. Clearly, Taiwan would prefer not to have to spend as much on its defence, but there is a public morale argument as well. I mean, given that the island is under constant attack from Chinese propaganda, I think to demonstrate to its own population that preparations are serious, are effective, and that the government takes the military threat seriously and isn't just relying on the United States is important for public morale.
It's a very difficult balance to strike, though, isn't it? Because when you think about it, China is the second biggest spender in the world on military investment. I think the last time its bill came through, it was $261 billion. You mentioned earlier that the entire Air Force could be taken out in one strike by the Chinese. Where does Taiwan say we have enough to keep China at bay, but we're not becoming overly militarized? Because effectively, that there is no point, is it?
Well, you're right. It is essentially impossible to guarantee that you could stand up to the Chinese military. And actually, even with United States assistance, this is becoming much less of an open and shut case than it was. You know, China has spent a great deal, for example, on its own submarine fleet. It's spent a great deal on displays at every military parade, some rather fearsome anti-ship missiles, and which are known as carrier killers. And it is spending a lot of money on cyber warfare of the kind that could interfere with military communications. So, you know, it's not entirely a given, as it perhaps used to be thought, that the United States would prevail against China, particularly if China were already in occupation of the island. So, you know, it is a very delicate situation. And I think in the end, Taiwan's best defense is is not so much the military cost of an occupation, but the diplomatic and economic cost to China of such a move. And so far that has been a sufficient deterrence, because there would be, I think, quite serious global consequences to an attempt by China militarily to take, you know, what is in fact a thriving democracy. However, there may come a moment when China calculates the United States' resolve is too weak. It might pick, the eve of an election. It could pick any moment in which the United States was distracted by something else. Or we might get another figure in the White House, you know, who couldn't be relied on. And then things do begin to look pretty, pretty delicate, I would say.
Finally, Isabel, let's mention briefly the creation of AUKUS yesterday, this pact amongst the UK, the US and Australia to supply submarines to Australia. The former Prime Minister of Britain, Theresa May, stood up in the Commons yesterday and asked whether the AUKUS pact could lead to war over Taiwan. How much of a point does she have?
Well, she has a point. I'm not sure the pact in itself is going to lead to war over Taiwan. After all, those submarines won't actually be in the water till 2040. So, you know, they're a declaration, if you like, of solidarity and military solidarity and concern over China. And certainly a nuclear powered submarine is a fearsome thing in modern marine warfare. However, it's not an immediate result. But I think the involvement of Britain in this arrangement is really a little puzzling, because I think it does raise the question of if Britain is committed to a military pact with the United States and Australia, which is clearly focused on Taiwan, who else is there, on China, who else is there in the region, then what does that say about Britain's willingness to join a fight if there were one? Because that is the implication, and certainly that is how China would read it. And I think there has been a little fudging from the British side about whether they mean it, and whether Britain is willing, or this government is willing, to take on the implications of joining this pact, which are an alienation of China. You know, China will certainly take it as a declaration of hostility, and whether Britain is willing to step up behind such a declaration should the occasion arise.
Isabel Hilton, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. In Berlin, 7:12 here in London. Now, Russians go to the polls this weekend to elect a new parliament, but the Kremlin has made it very clear that it won't tolerate any opposition. In recent months, dozens of people and organisations have been declared extremists or foreign agents, a status that severely limits their work and crucially bars them from running for office. Well, the authorities have also banned a website run by the team of the jailed opposition figurehead Alexei Navalny called Smart Voting, because it identifies candidates most likely to beat pro-Kremlin nominees. So what hope is there of a free and a fair election? Well, Monocle's Alexei Korolev heard from some of the few opposition candidates that have been allowed to run.
This election has already been called the most unfair in modern Russian history. That's because the authorities have done their utmost to stamp out any hint of dissent, any possibility that they might lose power. From the jailing of Alexei Navalny to the outlawing of his allies to the unprecedented crackdown on the free press and human rights activists, in the 20-odd years of Vladimir Putin's rule, things have never been more difficult for the opposition. But surprisingly, there's a handful of independent candidates still standing, still fighting.
Да, меня зовут Марина Литвинович. Я сейчас кандидат в Государственную Думу по одномандатному округу.
One of them is Marina Litvinovich. She's running on the ticket of Yabloko, Russia's oldest liberal party. But even she admits there's little chance she can pull it off. So why try?
Вы знаете, но я давно занимаюсь вот оппозиционной политикой, считайте, с 2005 года.
I have been in opposition politics since 2005, and I've had many reasons to give up since then. But I believe that I have chosen my path. I understand what I want. I want to be someone who will help Russia understand what's happening to it. I want our country to change, and I'll continue to do what I do despite all the difficulties and dangers.
Хотел ею заниматься, несмотря на все сложности, несмотря на все, так сказать, опасности этого пути. Mm.
The popularity of the ruling party, United Russia, has sharply declined in recent years as the country's economy slumped. The pandemic has made things even worse, and the Kremlin is worried because there's nothing it can do about it. But strangely, rather than prompt people to demand change, this has made them even more disillusioned with politics and politicians. Марина Литвинович again.
Ну вот главное, с чего они начинают, что все бесполезно, вы все равно ничего не исправите, наш голос ничего не значит, мы ни на что не можем повлиять. Поэтому они отказываются идти на выборы, отказываются меня поддерживать, и вот им приходится каждому доказывать, что...
The first thing that people say is that it's all futile, that their vote means nothing, that they can't influence anything. That's why they refuse to go to the polls, and I have to convince every single person that they should. To do it, I have to talk a lot. I have never talked so much in my life, but I can see that there is a real and serious rejection, even hatred, of politics.
Не знаю, насколько сработает ли это, вот, но реально отторжение политики очень серьезное, прямо ненависть к политике, там просто неприятие какое-то. Mm.
So is there any hope at all for the Russian electorate? Does Marina Litvinovich and other politicians like her still believe in their constituents?
Конечно, они многие понимают, что можно жить лучше. Не все, это на самом деле зависит от гражданской зрелости.
There is this Russian tradition of suffering, of postponing life. It's a leftover from Soviet times. But many people certainly understand that life can get better. This really depends on a kind of civic maturity. Our society is very traumatized. It is growing, but very slowly.
Гражданской зрелости такой, да? Процесс идет, но просто очень медленно, к сожалению.
And so this weekend will show just how much Russian society has changed. Has it changed enough to demand change? For Monocle in Moscow, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you very much indeed, Alexei. Now let's explore this further with Mark Galeotti, author of We Need to Talk About Putin, How the West Gets Him Wrong. Thank you for joining us as always, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
Now, you've written an article explaining why you believe this weekend's elections still matter. Is this perhaps because many people think that they don't?
Yes, I mean, there's a whole debate about whether or not it's worth participating and so forth. But when it comes down to it, you know, elections aren't just simply about the results. They're also about the whole process. And the thing about Russian elections is, we know that ultimately the Kremlin will record whatever results it wants to record. The real issue is how much effort does it have to put in to getting those results?
A lot at this time round, or not that much? I mean, we have heard a few moments ago that Alexei Navalny's smart voting strategy is being placed to try to shake up the Russian election.
Yes, and it's much broader. I mean, this is a different set of elections. I mean, not least precisely because of the truly vicious and wide-ranging campaign of repression that we've seen beforehand, essentially to break up and destroy Navalny's organization, but also to try and ensure that the traditionally house-trained so-called systemic opposition parties, which, you know, to a large extent can be considered fake opposition parties, but to keep them in line, stop them from actually becoming real opposition. And, you know, combine that with a whole set of pretty blatant attempts to buy votes, recent payments to pensioners and soldiers, for example. And it shows that actually the Kremlin is certainly not having an easy time in trying to ensure the kind of overwhelming victory that it wants to be able to record.
So how much will these elections shape Russia's future?
Well, I mean, on one level, the parliament, the State Duma, is, you know, not really a very powerful institution. This is a very, very presidential system. But the key reason why they're important and how they'll shape Russia in the future is because in some ways, these are a dress rehearsal for the elections that really matter in 2024. there's the presidential elections, and we presume that Putin will be putting himself forward for re-election. And again, although there's no doubt that he's going to win it, what we're seeing now is in some ways both the opposition and the Kremlin testing out the kind of tactics that they might want to try and use. This is in some ways an imagination race, as both sides are trying to see how they can actually ensure that they have their best chance of putting their best foot forward in 2024.
And what are we seeing being played out here?
Well, from the opposition's point of view, you've heard about smart voting, but also there is a rising new generation of people within either sort of truly opposition parties or the Communist Party, which is showing some signs of life. There are certainly some within it who want it to be a real opposition party. So they're looking for different ways of connecting to the audience, some of it by social media and online, and some of it by good old-fashioned campaigning, going out and speaking to people on the streets, because that's something that the state can't really control. On the other hand, the Kremlin is now looking for, they've got this three-day voting season, which they say is because of pandemia. But nonetheless, it's probably going to make it easier for them to try and rig the vote count. Likewise, they're testing out online voting, which again is much more convenient for the voter, but also much more convenient if you want to fiddle the results. So I think this is the kind of combination we're seeing. The state is using both repression and different ways of trying to make rigging the vote a little bit less obvious, because their big nightmare is what happened in Belarus last year, when Lukashenko, the dictator of Belarus, announced a totally implausible landslide victory. And the population was sufficiently incensed by that almost insulting move that they went out onto the streets. The Kremlin is wanting to try and ensure that its rigging is a little bit more subtle.
Insofar as they want to make sure that they have to allow any opposition speakers to speak in order to offer a semblance of fairness.
Exactly. This is a regime which doesn't want to just simply rule through with a fist of iron. It wants to maintain a degree of legitimacy. And, it has elections. It can't really cancel them without being very, very obvious about what kind of a regime it is. And therefore, however much it will obviously target particularly dangerous and high profile opposition figures, it has to allow at least a farce of an election, which does give people a chance to talk, to discuss, to campaign, and a new generation of political activists to begin to cut their teeth on real politics.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. That was a Russia expert, Mark Galliotti. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Well, we've just heard about the upcoming elections in Russia. Well, across the border, Bulgarians are going to the polls again. It's the third time there's been an election this year, with successive attempts to form a government coming undone. Let's hear from Boryana Jambazova, who's a journalist based in Sofia and a regular voice. Good morning, Boryana.
Good morning, Emma. Thanks for having me.
So we are now looking at a third election. What went wrong with the first two attempts?
It's going to be, as you pointed, the third election since April, basically. So it's been a busy political year for Bulgarians. Well, what went wrong is that none of the political parties in Bulgaria managed to gain enough support to form a majority government. Then all this endless, complicated political negotiations took place, and those failed as well. The last attempt after the July 11th vote actually included some controversial appointments by the party which won the election then. It was the party of entertainer turned politician Slavi Trifonov, and he failed basically to convince his potential allies, two small anti-corruption parties, that his suggestions for a government are the right choice, and those parties became increasingly disillusion that a coalition is possible.
So we have the parliamentarians being disillusioned that a coalition might be brought together. How about Bulgarian voters being asked to go to the polling booth for a third time this year, wondering whether something might actually, a decent result might be produced?
Right. Well, I must say, me and other fellow journalists were also kind of tired of, you know, covering election results this year. I can't imagine what it is for voters. But yes, some political observers are wary that, you know, there might be fewer people showing up to the polls, etc. And again, I want to emphasize how important and key the timing is, but Bulgaria is basically facing yet another wave of coronavirus. At the moment, we actually have the lowest vaccination rate in the whole of the European Union. And basically, the political limbo that we've been dealing with for months all is not helping. Basically, none of the politicians or the major political parties are ready to take any political risks or to do unpopular decision as like, let's say, a speeding vaccination campaign, etc., and more like embracing the idea. Plus, you know, Bulgaria has to apply for the EU recovery funds. And so there are a lot of important issues on the table, and this kind of political instability is definitely a key factor imposing this. But some people become outraged by the recent developments and the fact that the country is failing to produce a government. Some are, you know, still supporting their respective parties. But yeah, we'll see what happens in November.
Is there a sense that there will be some stability?
Well, this is the answer to the question that basically politicians and sociologists alike are dying to know. What we know for sure is that the election will fall on November 14th. The rest is basically unpredictable. Anything could happen. That's the thing that everybody is repeating, but we unfortunately don't know. There are hopes, for example, that there might be a different outcome this time, because two very popular ministers, they are both Harvard graduates, that actually gained a lot of support and popularity. They were members of the caretaker government appointed by President Roman Radev this past few months. They officially confirmed that they are entering politics because of procedural deadlines and limitations. They wouldn't be able to form their own party, but they are planning to participate in the next election. So again, given that they've been very popular, you know, they might be next election wild card of sorts.
Boriana Jambazova, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. The time is just coming up to 7:29 here in London. A quick look now at the latest headlines. Italy is to introduce some of the strictest coronavirus measures in the world, making it compulsory for all workers to have a COVID green pass, proof of vaccination, a negative test or recovery from the virus. Anyone without a pass will reportedly face suspension from work and may have their pay stopped. The aim is to boost the number of people being vaccinated. China has applied to join a key Asia-Pacific trade pact, the CPTPP. It's being seen as a move to strengthen its position in the region. The pact was originally created to counter China's influence. And the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has attempted to calm relations with France after the US, Australia and the United Kingdom signed a defence export contract to supply Australia with submarines. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said France was a vital partner in the Indo-Pacific region. France says it's been stabbed in the back. And the French President Emmanuel Macron has inaugurated an installation conceived by the late artist Christo that envelops Paris Arc de Triomphe in 2,500 square metres of plastic wrapping. This is the achievement of a 60-year-old dream, a crazy dream come true, says Monsieur Macron. And those are the headlines. It's time now on The Globalist for the final episode of this week's series, in which our bureau chief in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, has been profiling Canada's party political leaders ahead of the snap election that takes place on Monday. Well, today we turn our attention to the People's Party of Canada, which was established as a right-wing fringe group in 2018. Support for the party, however, has risen steadily in opinion polls during the course of this election campaign, in part thanks to the populist messaging of its leader, Maxime Bernier.
A crowd of protesters gathered outside the Canadian Museum of History last Thursday evening before the final televised leaders' debate ahead of Election Day this coming Monday. Their chant, "Let Max Speak." Max is Maxime Bernier, the former Member of Parliament who established the People's Party of Canada in 2018 after he lost his bid to lead his former party, the Conservative Party of Canada. Given that the People's Party had failed to poll at least 5% of public support ahead of this year's election debates, Bernier was denied a spot on the debate stage, to the anger of his supporters.
You can't divorce the People's Party from its leader, Maxime Bernier.
Gary Keller is a political commentator and a former senior member of the last Conservative government under then Prime Minister Stephen Harper.
Now, Maxime Bernier was a former leadership candidate for the Conservative Party. Maxime Bernier was very much a leader who was all about himself, quite frankly, and the fact that he didn't win the leadership of the Conservative Party. He increasingly was taking positions that were contrary to Conservative Party policy and then challenged the former leadership. And frankly, the Maxime Bernier, who is the leader of the People's Party, is not the same Maxime Bernier who was a Conservative cabinet minister.
What Keller means by that is that Bernier's views have swung further to the right since he set up his party, and he's been accused of pandering to an underbelly of political viewpoints. In 2019, a candidate for the party was expelled for apparently having asked Bernier to denounce white supremacist language within the party's ranks. And earlier this year, Bernier himself was accused of using a racist slur against Jagmeet Singh, the leader of the NDP, who's the first Sikh person to lead a national party here in Canada. Bernier has denied the claim. In terms of his party's messaging, it's the coronavirus pandemic, particularly lockdowns and nationwide vaccination programs, that has hardened Bernier's rhetoric and perhaps, in the eyes of a minority of voters, heightened his appeal.
I'm doing that as the leader of the People's Party of Canada, the only political party at the federal level that is fighting against these lockdowns. And the reason of my trip is to speak about that and giving the other side of the story to Canadians.
The People's Party's platform in this election reflects that entrenching of right-wing sentiment. There's a vow to protect personal freedoms and the right to freedom of speech. There's a promise to curb inward immigration and to slow the number of refugees who are resettled in Canada, which has been a flagship part of Justin Trudeau's premiership so far. There's scepticism of climate change. And above all, there's opposition to COVID-19 health measures. Bernier himself laid down his own gauntlet on that issue in June when he got himself arrested.
A federal party leader and vocal lockdown opponent has been arrested in rural Manitoba. RCMP took Maxime Bernier into custody for holding rallies and breaking public health orders.
So that's why I'm telling you we have the best platform for you, but not only for you, for the country. Because if we don't do these bold reforms, this country won't exist in 20 years.
There's a reason that Bernier's been compared to former US President Donald Trump. Putting Canada first has become a rhetorical theme for Bernier, a reference, of course, to the former US leader's America First lexicon. And many of the protests that have targeted Prime Minister Justin Trudeau during this campaign have been organised by supporters of the People's Party of Canada. Their trademark purple hats and placards with the white PPC acronym sewn or printed on them have been a visible and consistent presence in those angry crowds. And earlier this week, a 25-year-old local leader for the PPC was charged by police for having thrown stones at the Prime Minister during one particularly angry protest last week. The man has been expelled from the party. Gary Keller again.
Especially since the pandemic has started, the People's Party has become a home for, you know, people who are opposed to vaccination mandates, opposed to vaccinations altogether. And it really has become this catch-all of disgruntled, angry people. They're angry about a lot of things. And Mr. Bernier has only just fed those views.
A broader backdrop to Bernier's political brand in this campaign is an increasing concern of the effect that the dissemination of misinformation online is having on parts of Canadian society. This rebuttal by Justin Trudeau after one of the leaders' debates last week to a member of staff at Rebel News, which is a website that's accused of publishing inaccurate and sensationalist information online, demonstrates the strength of mainstream feeling growing against the rise of outlets like these in Canada.
Your group of individuals need to take accountability for some of the polarization that we're seeing in this country. And I think Canadians are cluing into the fact that there is a really important decision we take about the kind of country we want to see. And I salute all extraordinary, hardworking journalists that put science and facts at the heart of what they do and ask me tough questions every day, but make sure that they are educating and informing Canadians from a broad range of perspectives, which is the last thing that you guys do.
Support for the PPC in opinion polling during this campaign has grown to around 6%. That support is small and likely won't translate into any parliamentary seats on election day, but it is a rise worth noting, given that the PPC was hovering at around 3 or 4% support at the start of the campaign. The Canadian press is increasingly assessing what this might mean, both for Canada's political discourse, but also electorally for Canada's other parties, particularly the Conservatives. Away from politics, however, there's a serious question about whether the anger that's crystallised around the PPC during this election campaign is, in one way or another, here to stay.
And I believe that, you know, this party is growing and this election will be another important one for us.
For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Thomas Lewis.
And our thanks to Thomas for that. Concluding this week's series of profiles on Canada's party leaders, we'll have full coverage of Election Day in Canada, which takes place on Monday, all next week here on Monocle 24 on The Globalist. (Music) 7:37 here in London. Let's continue with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is a political journalist and author, Terry Stiesny. Good morning,
Good
Terry.
Morning.
All well in the world of news that we've got on the front pages? I imagine there's quite a lot of fallout over AUKUS.
Yes, that's right. AUKUS, I suppose. It is on many of the front pages in the UK. So obviously, as you'd expect, the two of the UK papers, The Times and The Guardian, both talking about the British political reaction. So The Guardian says UK and US face backlash amid fears pact could provoke China. And of course, this is all to do with the deal between Australia, UK and the US over submarines. And The Times headline is "Tell us if deal will drag Britain to war," the Prime Minister urged, which is referring to a question by Boris Johnson's predecessor, Theresa May, where she asked him what China's reaction was going to be. And she asked him in the House of Commons yesterday about the implications of the partnership in the event of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. And Boris Johnson, according to, said he didn't rule anything out in his response to his predecessor, saying that the United Kingdom remains determined to defend international law, and that is the strong advice we would give to our friends across the world and the strong advice that we would give to the government in Beijing. So there is a lot of sort of pickup on what this it means for sort of Britain's worldview, I suppose, and you know, the relations with the rest of the world. And I'll just mention there's quite an interesting sort of sidebar story here in The Times, which is saying that the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, is offering Boris Johnson a pact pact with the EU on defence and security cooperation. So there's going to be a meeting in Downing Street with the Dutch Prime Minister. And they said that last year Boris Johnson turned down negotiations on defence during the Brexit talks. But the Europeans now believe that something's changed here because they think that the government's more open to the idea of cooperating with the EU after America's behaviour over Afghanistan. And it says, you know, the EU's regarding this row with France as primarily a trade dispute, but, you know, saying hasn't been discussed at the political level. But this is not a big issue. But, yeah, it remains to be seen whether that's going to be the case.
Absolutely. I mean, it's amazing to see how different the reactions from the Netherlands and France have been to this. I mean, clearly, France is massively involved in this, having been a supplier of the previous batch of submarines and apparently was not even told that the contract was ending. And the French Foreign Minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, described it as unilateral, as a stab in the, unilateral stab in the back, I think.
Yes. Nice. Well, so Le Figaro here, but there goes obviously into the French political reaction and how this is, of course, going to play into the election campaign, which is already starting to heat up. And, you know, people are being very critical here, the French, the rivals to Macron. So it's camoufle is a word of French vocabulary word of the day, which means a snub and a humiliation. The political class is revolted, according to the Figaro's headline, by the cancellation of the sale of the submarines. And they say if it's been the Australia's decision has been unanimously denounced, but the opposition also see a sign of the weakness of the Macronist diplomacy, and saying this is a blow for French diplomacy. And mostly, it's primarily people on the right who are, you know, not surprisingly, the most critical of this. So Xavier Bertrand is saying this is the biggest French military contract has been cancelled. France is no longer respected by its allies, and they're worried about jobs in particular, as well as diplomacy. You know, Valérie Pécresse calls this a diplomatic snub, a worrying sign for our defence industry. And then, not surprisingly, of course, Marine Le Pen goes further and says, calls it a triple disaster, economic, military and political.
It isn't great for the French. And actually, many people have not really enjoyed the reaction from the French. It was just so hot-headed. Compare that with, as you mentioned a moment ago, Mark Rutte, who the Dutch Prime Minister, who's in London today. And it looks as if he is going to be trying to visit London to see the aligned security and defence interests that are happening with the UK. Yes, I think it's being accepted that it would have been nice if AUKUS had told everybody what they were just about to do. Mm. But calling for Europe to go on its own way on security is actually worrying some people, isn't it? That actually, if you do have someone who comes along and offers a conciliatory voice, good things might happen.
Well, yes. I mean, talking about the French, the sort of the haste of the French reaction, there's a little sort of mention in the New York Times, which I wanted to point out. So France apparently was going to have a gala in Washington to commemorate the 240th anniversary of the Battle of the Capes, which was going to celebrate the French Navy's help in a 1781 battle in
that
the War
is
of
not happening now, is it?
It's been cancelled.
It's been cancelled.
As of last night. We are not celebrating French-American naval cooperation.
No dressing up in capes
Hamilton
for you.
Type outfit. But yeah, I'm going to pick up the FT here. You know, again, saying the security accord delivers a blow to Brussels. So, you know, Josep Borrell, the EU sort of diplomatic head, saying, you know, he wasn't aware of anything. We were not involved in it. And just, you know, the FT is seeing this as a real snub to the EU security sort of arrangements as well.
Right. Let's move on to Der Standard in Austria. A lawsuit is beginning today where people who were affected by coronavirus in Ischgl, I think everybody remembers that was sort of the equivalent of, it was the equivalent of the Austrian wet market,
yes.
Is where this all started, and all these skiers came back and guess what?
Yes.
We all got COVID. Now there is it's actually going through a law process about liability, isn't it?
Yes. No, this is a really interesting story, which I think is going to go a long way. And it's also picked up by the Süddeutsche Zeitung in Germany, because some of the people affected by it were Germans who had been skiing in Austria. And the essential claim here, and the court case starting today, is that the way that they basically, what the Austrian government did is they said, well, we're going to put this resort into quarantine. And they're saying that this was badly handled in a way which allowed people to kind of spread across Europe and not to control the outbreak. And so they are accusing, many of the people who survived, who lost family members to coronavirus, are very, very angry with the Austrian government, and they would like the Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, to come and be a witness in this case. But the essential claim here is that because the Chancellor Kurz announced that he went and did a press conference. He said, look, this is a centre of infection. We are going to close down the resort. We are going to put it into quarantine. And they are claiming that he did that before there had been a plan to control what happened to all the people, so that people just obviously, as you would, got up and left before the quarantine was put in, and that so it allowed, as the Süddeutsche Zeitung describes it, under chaotic conditions, and many infected people went home and contributed to the Europe-wide spread of the virus.
It's absolutely shocking. I think we can maybe predict that this will not go in the claimant's direction, because if you have one government successfully sued for coronavirus measures, everyone else might want to join.
Well, I think it would be an interesting one to follow and to see what happens, and also to see, you know, who does have to come and give evidence in this case, and what's found out about the way things were handled in the early days of the pandemic.
Terry Stiassny, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time to talk travel now with the travel editor and writer Franziska Kellett. Good morning, Franziska.
Good morning, Emma.
Tell us what's happening with LVMH, the Cheval Blanc and the Samaritan.
Well, there's all sorts of stuff happening in Paris, yes. I mean, it's always been known for its incredible luxury hotels, all sorts of places like the Georges Cinq and the Ritz. It sort of invented the Palace Hotel. But now a new place has opened up, which has been a long time in the making. It's owned, as you said, by LVMH. It's Cheval Blanc. It opened last week, right on the banks of the Seine, and it looks like quite the showstopper for the city. Rooms start at €1,300 a night, so it's not exactly a snip, and it looks absolutely beautiful. It's got only 72 rooms, and the whole complex is actually part of this shopping centre, like you said, these old, wonderful, traditional shopping centres you find in Paris called Samaritain. This one was 16 years it took. It took LVMH to restore and to build up, and it cost them €750 million. So I think the result is quite impressive indeed. And the hotel is seen as a sort of showcase for the different brands of LVMH. So yeah, it's meant to be very beautiful indeed. It's also got the largest infinity pool in France, 100 feet.
Gorgeous. Oh. A wonderful revamp and lovely moment for LVMH and for Samaritain, and also a beautiful moment for Paris and its luxury hotels.
Yes, in general, there's lots of stuff happening. Kind of at the other end of the scale, of the luxury scale, Kimpton has just opened a new hotel. Also in another Art Nouveau Samaritain building, interestingly enough, another lovely Art Deco hotel. That's only €440 a night, so that is a snip compared to the other one. But then over in Versailles, this story is really interesting. They've opened up basically one of the smaller palaces within the grounds of the Palace of Versailles has now opened up as this beautiful luxury hotel. This building dates back to 1681, and this is another showstopper. It's all very Louis XVI, so very traditional, very opulent, very beautifully done. It's owned by the LOV Hotel Group, who spent €41 million and 5 years doing it up. They brought in all sorts of teams of historians, restoration experts, and it's just got 14 rooms. But what's really fantastic about this hotel is you have complete access to the main palace after hours. So you can go off and wander around the grounds at night. You can have private tours. You can go and stand in for example, the Hall of Mirrors completely alone, which I think must be an absolutely incredible experience. And those rooms cost 1,700 euros a night. So again, not cheap, but quite the experience.
It absolutely takes the idea of a palace hotel up to the next level, doesn't it? To be actually on the grounds of Versailles.
Yes, it does. It does. I mean, Paris is known for its palace hotels, but I think this is taking it on to another level, definitely.
Right. Let us move on to the change of travel rules here in the United Kingdom, at least. Much celebration here in the UK, given the fact that it now offers the opportunity for people to travel in the next couple of months, we think.
Oh, hopefully, finally, yes. I mean, it's once again all changed. It seems like every time I come on here, there's some sort of huge news to report. This time it sounds much more positive, though, and it sounds like these changes will be brought in time for the half-term holidays. So hopefully that's going to be announced today by Grant Chapps. The thinking is that the traffic light system, this horrible system of red, amber and green, is going to be scrapped, and they're going to completely get rid of amber, which has been this very confusing, muddling system right in the middle. So instead, they'll just have red and green. Currently, there's 62 countries on the red list, and they think that list will probably be halved, which is really quite significant. And some of the countries that will come off that list are hopefully going to be places like the Maldives, Turkey and Pakistan, which will all, of course, have significant impact to travel. The other big news is that ministers are planning to announce the scrapping of PCR tests for vaccinated people arriving into England, which is fantastic for inbound tourism. It also means, of course, travellers from England then don't have to test when they come back in. And they also don't need to do pre-departure COVID tests, which is going to bring down the cost of holidays quite significantly. I mean, some people are saying this is sort of too little, too late for the travel industry, which, of course, has suffered incredibly over the last 20 months. There was a report just this week, actually, from ABSA, saying new summer holiday bookings for this year were 1/6 of those for last year. So it's all been pretty bleak. So hopefully this will give them the boost they need, at least towards the end of the year.
Francisca Kellett, thank you so much for joining us. You were The Globalist on Monocle 24. And finally on today's programme, Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller takes stock of the week's stranger news headlines.
We learned this week that Wales had annexed, either accidentally or stealthily, a fair whack of England. A petition was submitted to the UK's Parliament about something or other, but rejected on the grounds that it was the responsibility of the Welsh Parliament. However, the whatever it was had something to do with the catchment areas of the Severn and Wye rivers, which, though they indeed rise in Wales, flow very much through or around Shrewsbury, Worcester, Hereford and Gloucester, all of which are in England. So we learned that either England is cunningly dumping unwanted counties on Wales, or Wales is surreptitiously seizing portions of England. Here with further explanation is Monocle 24's Greater Cymru Desk Chief, Thomas Lewis.
Ieffachgol, sut ti'n gwybod pwy amser yw hi yn Toronto? Gaf I fod gyda'r cachu hwch ma'n neud I?
Thanks, Thomas. But this was far from the greatest crisis to have beset the United Kingdom and indeed the world this week.
Go to the beach, eat, let's go get a wave.
For we learned a surprising amount about the testicles of a friend of a cousin of Super Bass and Starships hitmaker Nicki Minaj. Oh. Look, I don't write the news, okay? It is what it is. But we also learned how inextricably enmeshed the worlds of politics and entertainment have become, to the enlargement of the dignity of neither. And we learned that, while the dignity of neither of those two things had been enlarged, two other things had.
No, don't. No,
no, no. No,
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 really.
Please,
seriously.
No,
please
don't. Don't need to hear it.
Way.
Oh, God, Andrew, no.
I've got big balls. I've got big balls.
The wretched saga commenced when Ms. Minaj departed from her usual métier of high-velocity hen party hip-hop and ventured into vaccine disinformation. She tweeted to the effect that, and we think we've got this right, though don't really care all that much, that a mate of her cousin in Trinidad, after receiving the jab, had been struck impotent, cursed with swollen gonads, and subsequently suffered the heartbreak of having his wedding called off by a disappointed intended. We learned, for starters, that Minaj's cousin's mate is actually pretty quick on his feet, however uncomfortable such movements may presently be for him. While there are ailments congruent with such symptoms, they are not caused by receiving COVID-19 vaccines, but generally by other behaviours indeed likely to result in the returning of engagement rings if discovered. Minaj's cousin's mate, should he in fact exist, a question to which we will return, is doubtless not the first to have tried to style such an indiscretion out. We learned, however, that this was to have consequences. Well, quite. Do we have a sound effect of an escalator to indicate that matters escalated? A member of the British media felt it necessary to test Minaj's assertion against the wisdom of the UK government's chief medical advisor, Dr. Chris Whitty, who was not having it.
There are also people who go around trying to discourage other people from taking a vaccine which could be life-saving or prevent them from having life-changing injuries to themselves. And many of those people, I regret to say, I think know that they are peddling untruths, but they still do it. In my view, they should be ashamed.
Whitty was supported in this stand with positively Churchillian resolve and a spectacular handbrake segue by the Prime Minister.
I'm not familiar with the works of Nicki Minaj as I probably should be, but I am familiar with Nicki Kanani, a superstar GP of Bexley, who's appeared many times on before you, who will tell you that vaccines are wonderful and everybody should get them.
At which point, Minaj struck back in an accent very nearly as heavy on the Woodhousian affectations as Boris Johnson's own.
Yes, hello, Prime Minister. Boris, it's Nicki Minaj. I was just calling to tell you that I thought you were so amazing on the news this morning, and I'm actually British.
By this point, however, the inanity vortex was well and truly awhirl, with top US boffin Dr. Anthony Fauci struggling not to wonder out loud why at this point he's even bothering attempting to preserve the health of people who would rather take medical advice from unqualified yahoos on the internet than people who have some idea what they're talking about, like, for example, himself.
Dr. Fauci, is there any evidence that the Pfizer, the Moderna, or the J&J vaccines cause any reproductive issues in men or women?
The answer to that, Jake, is a resounding no.
Can we get a resounding no? But lost amid this brouhaha was what we did not learn, but really should have by now, which was the lesson about the perils of paying any heed whatsoever to attention-seeking celebrity nitwits. For we learned from Dr. Terence Dale Singh, Health Minister of Trinidad and Tobago, that the entire story was a load of Nicki Minaj's cousin's mate's affected glands.
One of the reasons we could not respond yesterday in real time to Miss Minaj is that we had to check and make sure that what she was claiming was either true or false. And unfortunately we wasted so much time yesterday running down this false claim. There is absolutely no reported such side effect or adverse event of testicular swelling in Trinidad, or I dare say, Dr. Hines, anywhere else. None that we know of anywhere else in the world.
This is probably all still going on if you're late to it but fancy joining in. But not, now this is a segue, if you're listening in the German settlement of Schmallenberg Oberkirchen.
Gotta get the mail through Pony Express. Gotta get the mail through. Gotta get the mail through, no time for rest.
Which actually, for reasons we shall shortly arrive at, you're probably not doing either. For we learned that the internet in Schmallenberg Oberkirchen is slow, as was demonstrated by a local magazine which tested an online transfer of 4.5 gigabytes of photos to a destination 10 kilometers away against a messenger carrying a DVD on a horse. The horse won. We further learned on actually bothering to read all the way to the bottom of exactly the sort of fleetingly viral story that we lazily assemble this monologue from every week, that it was actually datelined last December. But that's probably just how slow Schmallenberg-Oberkirchen's internet is. Look, you think this is easy, you come up here and do it. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you so much, Andrew. And that's all we have time for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Daniel Bache, Paige Reynolds and Charlie Filmer-Court, our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager, Chris Ablakwa, with editing assistance from Christy Evans and Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist back on Monday. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.